Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your host from SteelersDepot.com, where you can find all your latest and greatest Steelers news. It's Dave Bryan and Alex Cazora, always lit, talking Steelers. And now, here's Dave and Alex.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast, Season 14, Episode 91. He's Josh Carney. I'm Alex Cazora, SteelersDepot.com. Thanks for being back with us here this Friday, Steelers Nation. Dave Bryan on a bit of vacation right now. I think he'll be visiting Joe Clark up northeast in a couple of days, and he's out back in his stomping grounds of Florida right now. So going to have some guests on, I think, for the next couple of episodes until Dave gets back in a couple of episodes from now. So as you guys heard, filling in today is our Josh Carney, who isn't too far removed from his time in Frisco, Texas for the Shrine Bowl, wasn't able to come on the Shrine Bowl show. And so I figured I'd invite Josh on now, get his thoughts on what happened in Frisco, get his thoughts on what's happening in Pittsburgh right now. So thanks for being on, Josh.
Yeah, thanks, Alex, for having me. I really appreciate you guys bringing me on again. And yeah, I hope Dave is getting much needed relaxation here on this trip.
I hope so as well. All right, let's. There's really no major, to my recollection, at least in terms of major Steelers news occurring. So let's just kind of jump right into the Shrine Bowl and what you observed down there. It was the first time it was in Frisco, Texas. And how many years had you been there by now? It's been first time in Texas, I know, but several times for the Shrine Bowl.
This was my third trip to Shrine Bowl. So I did the first 2 years in Vegas, and then obviously this year in Frisco. So it's gotten better and better each year. I know that I had some reservations about them moving to the Dallas Cowboys practice facility this year, just because I thought Vegas was so smooth the last 2 years. But fantastic time. It was myself, Joe Clark, Tony Calderon, and Dr. Mel were down there, and an awesome team there for Steelers Depot. We had a blast, and I thought the East West Shrine Bowl crew, the actual East West Shrine Bowl, did a great job putting that event on. And the Dallas Cowboys practice facility is spectacular. I mean, it might rival some actual stadiums in the NFL, how beautiful that place is. So it was a blast. And we saw a lot of very good prospects that I'm sure we'll talk about here.
Was there any difference in terms of the format or layout or even how the coaches ran the practices? How do they determine the Shrine Bowl coaching staff? Is that per team, like the old school way, or is that pieced together the way the Shrine Bowl or the Senior Bowl, has done the last two years?
It's pieced together. So the last few years, it had been specific teams. I know last year in Vegas, it was ironically the Falcons with Arthur Smith and the Patriots with Troy Brown was leading the group, but Bill Belichick was there. But this year, a lot of it was just really pieced together, giving some lesser known guys some opportunities. I know Mike Kafka was the coach for one team, and then Chicago Bears, Richard Hightower was the head coach for the other team. But there were a lot of different position coaches there, assistant position coaches that were really getting a shot to run position groups and have more exposure. I know Gerald Alexander, former assistant safeties coach for the Steelers, was there. He's now reportedly moved on to Vegas. He's still on the team website for the Steelers at last glance, but he ran a position group. There were a lot of guys that were experienced coaches but needed more exposure that certainly got that opportunity.
And Alexander, he was in Raiders uniform whenever he was down there, right? That was after the announcement.
No, he didn't have any team colors on. A lot of it was just standard, gray Nike or Under Armour that day. And then he had some East West Shrine Bowl gear on, but no Raiders, no Steelers, nothing like that. So it was very curious that report was out there.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't see him on the Raiders website, just kind of their main public page. So we'll keep an eye on it. It was reported to have happened, so we'll keep you updated there. In terms of the layout and the format of the week, was it any different than past Shrine Bowls at this new location?
No, not really. You know, obviously from the media standpoint, we had our sessions in the Hyatt Regency. It was right outside where the players were meeting with the teams. So it was just kind of that car wash. You go through the speed dating with the players and the teams, and then you get like an hour with certain position groups. There was less space in the media section. There were a lot more, you know, video and audio podcasts that were there that kind of pushed the print media guys to the side. But as far as the practices go, no, it was pretty much the same thing. You know, we had free run of the place. We could sit in the stands to get a better view. We could be right there on the sideline. Just a great time again. And Eric Galco and his staff with the Shrine Bowl just do a fantastic job. And they've taken it to new heights here in the last few years.
Absolutely. It's really grown, I think, by leaps and bounds. So excited to hear about that. I did actually just check here. Gerald Alexander, his Twitter page and his LinkedIn account both reflect working for the Raiders. So I assume that's what's happening, despite some of the weirdness about that being announced publicly by apparently both teams. All right, Josh, I'm just going to give you some really broad questions. And I usually hate to do that, but I think you can take the baton here. Who stuck out? And did you have anyone you were going into Texas wanting to watch in particular? If so, what was your evaluation of them, and why did you want to watch them as you approached the week?
I was very excited when I saw that Texas A&M's Edgerrin Cooper, inside linebacker, was going to be at the East-West Shrine Bowl. And then we get there, and he was not participating in the week, just doing team interviews, which, I mean, is smart. He's a top 50 prospect. There is some buzz that he could go in the back end of the first round. But really, I was going in, I was looking at the linebackers just because I feel that that's an area of need for the Steelers. It feels like it has been every year at this point. One name that really caught my eye, Alex, over the week was Dallas Gant, a linebacker from Toledo. We know how the Steelers love their MAC guys, but this guy also went to Ohio State for a few years. I thought he was one of the best athletes on the field, regardless of position, throughout the week. He just made plays in the passing game. He was all over the place in the run game. I think he checked in just under 6'3", 225 pounds. I'm having a tough time tracking down Toledo defensive tape. He really caught my eye throughout the week. And then a guy that I just actually did a profile on, I believe it went up Thursday morning, Florida State's Renardo Green, a cornerback. The guy played press man coverage 78% of the time in college last year at Florida State, and he thrived on an island. A little undersized, 5'11", 31-inch arms, but man, he's got a bulldog mentality, and he just locked guys up throughout the season. So those two caught my eye down there. Offensive line play was a little disappointing, especially for the East team. They were overmatched throughout the week. And then again, you know, for the third year in a row, you come out of the East-West Shrine Bowl feeling a little underwhelmed with the quarterback play. But the 2 years before that, you had Brock Purdy, and then you had Tommy DeVito. So it's like one of those guys that was at the East-West Shrine Bowl this year, quarterback-wise, could be that rookie sensation here. But yeah, just a great week. A lot of guys that really made some plays. And I think, again, you know, they had Zay Flowers last year. This year, I don't think Virginia's Malik Washington is going in the first round, but he was very clearly the best player down there right from the start. Just a fantastic receiver. You look at his tape, he looks a lot like Tyreek Hill, kind of that smaller, thick build, makes a lot of guys miss and has great speed. So I did a profile on him for the site as well. But yeah, there were a lot of Steelers front office members down there as well. I don't have that pulled up in front of me, but I believe it was close to 10 personnel overall. So that's up from previous years.
Probably helps that the locations were closer this year. Being in Texas and Mobile, not as far of a trip there with how stacked these events are, basically in almost back-to-back weeks with some overlap there. On the quarterbacks, I know you said they were underwhelming, and that was kind of the feeling from everyone we talked to previously, but was there, if you had to pick one name that stuck out, or just even beyond the Shrine Bowl week, just kind of what you know about them and their tape potentially, any late day three guys? Because I think if Pittsburgh does draft a quarterback, which those odds I think are very real, but it's going to be a day three type as opposed to a top two round type of guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd probably lean more towards Taulia Tagovailoa. I thought throughout the week he just got better and better. Early on, you know, obviously in these all-star type formats, they're throwing to receivers they're not used to. They're in a system they're not used to. The first few days can be a bit rough. But I thought he settled down late in the week. I thought he looked good in the game itself. And obviously we know the bloodlines there. He's Tua's younger brother. So I thought he impressed me. And, you know, I did like Jack Plummer out of Louisville throughout the week. He's more of that experienced pocket passer type guy, decent arm. He just read things well throughout the week, but then obviously in the game, he really underperformed. But I think Talia Tagovailoa is that guy that I'm kind of watching there on day three. That could be that guy that gets an opportunity in the season and maybe runs with it.
Can you talk about Renardo Greene a bit more? You mentioned the profile. I know you said his, you know, man heavy usage with the Seminoles, but just more background on him. And do you see him as a true fit in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I do. And honestly, going into the week, I started to do, you know, some background on him, and I saw the man heavy scheme. I saw, you know, Pro Football Focus had him highly rated in man coverage. I do think he's a fit. He did show some work in the slot as well. There were some reps against the run where I just thought he was out of position and didn't really want to stick his face in there. But then there were also some reps. I have one in the profile where he flies downhill and lays the smack down to a Clemson running back. I really like his physical mentality, his ability to mirror in coverage. It felt like at times he was running routes for receivers, which when you see that from a young corner, it's really impressive. My only real knock on him was his inability to finish in coverage. He had, you know, 22 passes defensed in his career. He had 13 last year, but just one interception. And that kind of sounds to me like Joey Porter Jr., quite honestly. Mm-hmm. But on tape, Greene had a couple of dropped interceptions. So I do worry a little bit about the hands, but just from a play style and his ability to thrive on an island, be aggressive in press coverage and kind of shut down some top talent. It really stood out to me. If you want to get a good feel for him, watch the LSU game to open the year last year. He shut down Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas, two guys that are getting top of the first round buzz right now. And, you know, I think with Greene, he's going to go to the combine. I think he's going to test relatively well. And I think as more and more people get to him, they're going to realize, hey, this guy could probably step in quickly in the NFL and handle a starting role.
He's more of an outside guy. I know you said he played in the slot a bit, but is he next level in the outside corner?
Yeah, I think so. He definitely has that versatility to move inside. But he a lot of his snaps were outside aligned, and he was, you know, put up at the line of scrimmage. Hey, press this man. You got this guy shut down this side of the field. And that allowed Florida State to do quite a bit around him from a coverage standpoint. But I definitely think he's able to float, you know, inside and outside, but I think he's at his best when he's outside in that man coverage. He does have some issues in zone. He kind of floats around in zone, kind of gets lost at times. I think he's much better when he's in phase with a receiver and has a guy rather than an area.
Gotcha. And then in terms of round, it's a pretty strong and deep cornerback class. Where do you think roughly he's projected to go?
Yeah, I think he's going to go in the third round. I had a late day two grade, so that's, you know, third round roughly. I could see him falling to the fourth round just because of the size. You know, like I said, 5'11", 31-inch arms, that might, you know, worry some teams, especially with the lack of ball production. But I have him in the third round. Wouldn't shock me if he goes in the second because of his success in press man. But this guy, yeah, I think third round, certainly top 75 at this point. I really think you're going to start to hear his name more and more as we get closer to the draft.
Looking more broadly at the, you know, secondary group overall, you know, I focused a lot on the outside corner, and maybe too much because there's slot corner concerns. I mean, even if you assume Patrick Peterson will be kept in terms of, you know, potential rundown guys, and of course the future, Peterson does return. I think 2024 is likely it for him in the NFL and in Pittsburgh. Safety's questionable. Besides Minka, it's strong safety. What are you going to do there? Will you keep Casey and Neil? One of those guys, I think Neil more likely than Casey can get cut, and they just need some youth and some speed, I think, at that safety group overall. So what other, you know, DBs from that week stood out to you, even beyond guys who just play outside corner?
You know, honestly, MJ Devonshire stood out quite a bit. The Pitt kid grew up, went to Aliquippa. He is strictly an outside corner, though. He doesn't have the size or the physicality to play inside. But really, again, a guy, you know, man coverage, put him on an island. Pitt has done that the last few years under Pat Narduzzi, and they've produced some cornerbacks at the NFL level that have played well right away. I thought he had a really good week. Jarius Monroe from Tulane, really surprised me. He came into the week listed as a cornerback, and he spent the entire week at safety, kind of playing that center field role in the single high. I believe he was, if I'm recalling correctly, the defensive MVP of the game because he had an interception. I think he can handle the slot. He played outside at Tulane, but just his ability to read plays, his physicality coming downhill, his communication stood out big time. That's a guy that I have circled, kind of a day three target. I believe he was a team captain at Tulane. I'm sure we'll have a profile on him at some point. But those were the two that really, stood out to me as guys that could be fits in Pittsburgh, but also just had a really good week overall.
Were you the one to talk to Devin Shire? Did you speak with
yes,
him?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Do you know?
Yeah, I talked to.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to ask, do you know the backstory why he went to Kentucky first and then what led him back to Pitt, other than obviously it being his hometown?
Yeah, I believe Pitt offered late when he was coming out of Aliquippa, which is really surprising. I mean, mm-hmm. It's right in their backyard. They've kind of had issues in the past with some of their backyard talent, but he went to Kentucky trying to, get a foothold in that SEC. And I believe he started a year there. Didn't have quite as much success as he was expecting. And then, he went into the portal and Pitt was there and he saw the success that Narduzzi has had putting corners on an island in man coverage and letting them thrive. And that's really his game. I mean, he's not going to press you, but he's going to mirror with you. He's going to run with you. He'll wall you off at times, but his footwork is outstanding. He's just always right there with the receiver and that was unlocked at Pitt because, they play that man coverage. They're going to put their corners on an island. They're going to blitz a lot. And he thrived in it. He didn't say this, but I definitely think he was regretting the whole SEC path initially just because he wasn't seeing the field as often as he expected. And it helped coming home. He could just be himself and he landed in a situation that was fantastic for him. And it paid off the last 2 years. I think he had 8 interceptions in 2 years and 3 of them were pick sixes, which is a school record. So great ball skills. And he has a nose for the end zone.
One of which was against West Virginia in
yes,
that
it was.
Backyard brawl. And obviously that's the play he's going to be remembered for in Pitt for a long, long time. Yeah. They run man, they run cover 4 under Pat Narduzzi, which puts more stress on the corners to match things vertically, not as much safety help. And so you can kind of see the parallels. And he's long. He's 33 and a quarter on the length for being a 5'11". I mean, he's not particularly heavy, 179, but that length for that frame is pretty interesting.
Yeah, the only real concern I had with him was just, how skinny his lower half was. Mm-hmm. He's got a thin, wiry lower half. But yeah, he has great length. It showed throughout the week. Like I said, he's not going to be overly physical and really jam guys at the line of scrimmage, but when he has to get his hands on you, he can kind of redirect you and he's able to make a ton of plays just being able to recover and run in the hip pocket. It showed up a lot throughout the week, and once they got into team sessions, quarterbacks just were not testing him because they knew it wasn't going to work out, and he shut down the complete side of a field throughout the week.
One question I usually like to ask these guys for these roundtables, and I forgot to, I think the Shrine Bowl and the Senior Bowl discussions was the small schoolers, because those games, the Shrine Bowl, the Senior Bowl, they're so important for the FCS level or even D2, mm-hmm. D3 guys to play up and go against that, top FBS Power 5 competition and get that more even playing field. It's really important for Pittsburgh. I remember Javon Hargrave, I think, really became a Steeler because how much he dominated in the Senior Bowl, and I think he was at the Shrine Bowl prior to getting the call up. So that's really, really important for Pittsburgh. Were there any small school guys, FCS and below players that stuck out to you?
The South Dakota State contingent that was there, Mason McCormick, he's played guard, he's played center. He was terrific throughout the week. I think he really boosted his stock quite a bit. It was a little disappointing to see Jalen Coker, the Holy Cross receiver. He went down with an injury, I believe, on day 2. I think Joe Clark had the report initially that he'd met with the Steelers both at the Hula Bowl and here at the Shrine Bowl, and then he went down. But really, a lot of it was – it wasn't like years past where there was those small school guys where it was like, oh, okay, you're really bursting on the scene. You're showing you belong here. The one guy, though, that – caught my attention was the Quantes Stiggers, the CFL guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw he didn't get a combine invite, which was rather surprising, but I know he's not quote unquote small school, but just a really unique story. And he held his own throughout the week. I thought he had a really good day three of practice, and I thought he looked relatively good in the game. But yeah, this year, not a ton of small school guys that really, blew up outside of McCormick.
Gotcha. And then just kind of a last question. Anybody else to mention any position that stuck out to you in a positive or negative fashion?
Yeah, I'll go to the edge rushers. I thought that the Murphy brothers from UCLA were really impressive. They could not be blocked throughout the week whatsoever. It didn't matter who was put on them. They dominated. There was one team session where the offense couldn't run a single play for like four or five straight reps because the Murphy brothers were blowing it up coming off the edge. The other guy, I was watching a lot of Steel Chambers at linebacker just because one, I love the name, and two, it always catches my eyes when a guy goes from running back to linebacker and has that type of athleticism. I thought he played physical throughout the week, but I was a little concerned about him in coverage. But that was the most interesting interview that I had down in Dallas because he actually took over the interview at one point and was asking me questions that made me think. So, just a very interesting guy. Part of me hopes he winds up being a Steeler, just to see how the media deals with him, because I think he would really challenge them and be quite unique for us to watch.
What was he asking you?
He asked me what four animals I would take to war with me.
Just out of the blue, like he just jumped in and asked that.
Yeah, he said, "Can I ask a question?" And I went, "Oh boy, go ahead." And he hit me with it, and he had his answers. I can't remember off the top of my head what
Oh,
his answers.
I want to know his answers. Yeah.
Let me. Okay, so it was a saber-toothed tiger.
Okay.
It was a hippo, an elephant, and then there was one more that I'm not. Oh, a polar bear. Polar bear is his
Okay.
favorite animal.
Oh,
And
nice.
he gave me reasons for it, and he said, "What for would you be battling against me with?" And put me on the spot, and I was dumbfounded. Like I was expecting something random, but not that random. But yeah, he had a full explanation for every animal that he chose, and just a really unique guy. Reminded me, quite honestly, of Najee Harris, just out there, marching to the beat of his own drum. Just a very unique guy, and he was quite personable when he was one-on-one. But yeah, I really hope that guy somehow winds up being a Steeler just for the type of content we could get throughout the year.
Put that in the scouting report for sure. Because you did the report on
Yes,
Chambers too, right? What was your
I did.
overall takeaway of just watching the tape and not just the Senior Bowl or the Shrine Bowl?
Yeah, I liked the way he played the run. I thought he was just a really smart player, able to kind of get through that traffic early on, find the football. He just My issue was his ability in coverage. They never really asked him to play man all that much, and in zone, again, he knows how to gain depth, but he never really had that feel for how to play zone. Teams kind of went right after him, throwing over him, throwing behind him, into windows that he was kind of leaving there. But if you want a guy that can step in right away, first two downs, run downs, I think he's your guy. He knows how to find those gaps. He's a former running back. He just has a nose for the football, and I think that showed up this past season. He was a leading tackler for Ohio State, even ahead of Tommy Eichenberg, who coming into the year was considered one of the best linebackers in college. So, yeah, I really liked his tape against the run. I like how he found the football, but there are some concerns in coverage. So if you were projecting him to the Steelers, he'd probably be more of that buck, that downhill guy.
Gotcha. No, really good information there. Let me ask you actually just one more question. If you don't have information, that's fine. I know I'm just we're putting you on the spot. We didn't have the Dave and I patented 2-hour pre-production meeting that we always have, as you guys know. But I asked this question because there was an interview that Justin Mello from the Draft Network did with Doug Nestor, the offensive guard, offensive tackle from West Virginia, and he mentioned he had a couple of really good meetings with Pittsburgh. Obviously, they meet and talk with a bunch of guys, so we're not putting too much stock into that. But, we talk about West Virginia offensive linemen, we're usually focusing so much on Zach Frazier, Nestor, a guy that hasn't been really talked about much. Did you or anybody else down there get any information on him in the week that he had?
We didn't get a chance to talk to him. I know that during that session, I think we had four or five other linemen that we were speaking with. But really, he was right guard only at West Virginia. I think he had, trying to recall off the top of my head here, more than 35, 40 starts at right guard. Mm-hmm. But the really cool thing was is the coaching staff challenged him throughout the week. He had snaps at center. He had snaps at both tackle positions. Mm. He just a very, very huge lineman. I think 6'7" is what he checked in at. But yeah, in college, he was really only at right guard. But you can see, you know, the size and the strength show up throughout the week. And he picked up the tackle positions rather quickly. Now, I don't know if he was working at tackle during practice at West Virginia or whatnot, but
I think he was right tackle his senior year. I think he played some right tackle. Okay. I believe so. The little I have on him.
Okay. I know that he was mostly right guard, though. Right. But yeah, that was the thing where I can't recall what team he was on down there, whether it was East or West, but that team was challenging everyone to play out of position at times. And I mean, there were some snaps he had at left tackle that were pretty solid as well. So, That's really all the information, but I did see that from the Draft Network, and it makes sense. I mean, he was a multi-year starter, a big guy, and he showed some versatility throughout the week.
Yeah, he's got a ton of experience. He's got some size. I think he played hurt in 2023, he was saying, and he had a good Shrine Bowl weekend, so that's a guy I do want to watch. He's a later-round guy, you know, day three, not going to go as high as Frazier, who could be a potential day one guy, but I think maybe more likely early day two, somewhere in round two for Pittsburgh. But I did want to mention that because that was a story we wrote about here on Thursday. And by the way, Josh and I are recording this here on Thursday night, posting this on Friday. So just if anything crazy happens from, you know, now until then, we didn't cover it, and that'd be the reason why. All right. Going just kind of looking at your draft profiles, you've done a couple of them. You mentioned Green, Chambers. Have any other profiles you've done of maybe non-Shrine Bowl prospects you wanted to talk about and guys that might fit Pittsburgh?
No, honestly, you know, Edgerton Cooper was the first one I did. I kind of focused early on some of the Shrine Bowl guys just because I saw them in person. You know, I worked through Kentucky's Trevin Wallace here the last few days. That'll go up online on Friday. He was a guy that I was stunned when I saw Chad Reuter had him in his most recent three-round mock in the first round to the Steelers. You know, I watched five games of his. I don't quite see first-round guy, but again, just a shade under 6'2". He checked in at, I think, 244 pounds at the Senior Bowl. He's got some decent athleticism, but he's just kind of that big lumbering linebacker, kind of struggles again in coverage. Plays the run well, but I can't get over the fact that Reuter had him in the first round. It could happen because of his size, and he's one of the bigger linebackers in the class. But I was expecting a little more going into his tape, and I think you'll see some of that in my profile here on Friday. But I really just focused on the Shrine Bowl guys, like I said, because those are the guys I saw in person and wanted to knock those out.
Gotcha. No, great coverage from you, from the entire crew, Mel, Joe, Tony. I think you guys just crushed it and gave us a ton of good information to work with. So thank you guys for that. I want to transition now to some of the coaching hires, and Dave and I have kind of covered all the hires by now. Arthur Smith, of course, the new OC, Tom Arth, the quarterback's coach, and Zach Azzani, the new wide receiver's coach. But you had done one of the write-ups on Azzani, who the more that I've learned about him from reading your article a couple of days ago and some of the research that I've done, I would say whatever it's worth, and probably not worth much, but I think he's my favorite hire of the couple they've made so far, of Arthur Smith and then Azzani, and I think he's the right guy for what Pittsburgh needs. But kind of go into his background some, and what's your thoughts on the hire of Zach Azzani as a new wide receivers coach?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. This is my favorite hire they've made so far. They needed a guy that would come in and not only demand respect, but have that accountability. You know, kind of things kind of went off the rails in the last few years, and that's not to put down Frisman Jackson. I think he had a, you know, kind of a tough task coming in with some of these receivers, Deontay Johnson, George Pickens, and not having as much experience. But Azzani comes to the table. He's been coaching receivers for 25 years, whether that's at the college level or at the NFL level. He's had a lot of success, and really, I think your article the other day highlighting some of his quotes from his time in college, that is exactly what the Steelers need in this receiver room. You know, Allen Robinson tried to be that veteran leader. You know, I think his voice fell on deaf ears at times, and I don't think that's going to happen with Azani when it comes to Johnson and Pickens. This is a guy that he's going to be in your face. He's not going to care about your feelings. He's going to, you know, demand accountability, demand respect. He's going to want you to focus on the little things. And if you don't live up to that standard, it doesn't matter what your name is or how much money you make, you're not going to play under him. And I think in the past, we've kind of seen the Steelers let that get away a bit, you know, let some of these guys get away with some stuff. And I don't think Azani's going to allow that. This is a guy that played receiver himself in college. You know, he spent 4 years at Central Michigan, and then he went off and coached under some really good coaches throughout his time in college, spent a few years under Urban Meyer. You know, this is a guy that he's had a track record of success. And I think that is what this team needed. I think they tried it before with Ike Hilliard, and again, that lasted 2 years. And it now, Alex, for me, it feels like this team has a guy in place that could be that long-term answer. They haven't had that answer since, unfortunately, Darryl Drake passed away, and they've kind of just been, you know, flipping through guys here. But I feel like Azani's going to put an end to that cycle, and I think it'll be for the best for the Steelers, because obviously they're going to invest in receivers again and again. That's just what this team does. And to have that guy with his track record and his coaching style is going to be huge.
I agree. I think he's going to be someone that's going to hold these guys accountable. They're going to butt heads. There's going to be some times where Deontay Johnson, George Pickens do not like Zach Azani, but I say good. And those things get worked out. And I think you had the comment from Emmanuel Sanders. He talked about butting heads with Azani, but over time, they, you know, came to really respect each other. And they just need some tough coaching, guys that will set a high standard, keep that standard high, won't allow guys to round off routes, not show effort. The guys have to be detail oriented consistently and do that every single practice, every single game. And I think once you kind of dive into his background, as you laid out, you really understand why he was the perfect hire.
Yeah. And I think in the past 2 years, we've seen, you know, Pickens and Johnson have some of these sideline antics directed probably more towards Frisman Jackson, and Jackson never really pushed back. Again, this isn't an indictment on Jackson, but I don't think this is going to happen with Azani. You're going to see these guys butt heads for sure. We'll probably hear about it even throughout the week during practices. You know, Emmanuel Sanders had that quote that I had in my original article, just the way Azani came in and was like, this is how we're going to do things today. This is how we're going to do things throughout the week. And that rubbed that veteran the wrong way. That's going to happen in Pittsburgh, you know, and Azani's going to have to set his foundation. But this is a guy, again, who he's shown to be able to develop guys, get the best out of them, but also have that accountability. And like I said, Pittsburgh hasn't had that, and it feels like they have that now. And there's been a cultural shift a bit on the offensive side of the football, because I think Arthur Smith is kind of the same way. And, you know, I wrote this in my piece. I think Azani is a perfect fit under Arthur Smith. Just, you know, reading your big book on Arthur Smith and what he wants at the receiver position and how Azani expects his receivers to play, it meshes perfectly. And hopefully we see it mesh well on the field here in 2024.
It's going to be some tough love, I think, on that coaching side of the football, which, again, for the third youngest offense in football, the Steelers were in 2023, they need that kind of stuff. And I think Azani's been respected. I mean, it's not all just drill sergeant. I mean, he cares about his guys from the comments and what he's talked about. So it's not just ragging on these guys all the time, but when there's a time, you know, to hold them accountable, he's not going to ever kind of let stuff slide.
Yeah. And I think the thing that stood out to me, I watched a mic'd up segment from him at Denver Broncos training camp in 2021. I want to say, and the energy that this guy brings, Alex, I cannot wait to read your reports from training camp here with the receiver group. I mean, he was tough on guys, but he was also the first one down the field. You know, they showed a clip of Deontay Spencer, there's a name to remember, catching a touchdown pass in training camp. And Azani sprinted down the field to celebrate with Spencer. He did the same thing with Jerry Jeudy. Like, this guy is going to obviously demand that respect, but he's also going to show love to his guys and bring that energy daily. And I think this is a great hire. I know people were like, that's the name they went for. Granted, because a lot of people wanted Hines Ward, and understandable, but they needed a guy with serious, you know, a serious resume, serious experience. And I really think they hit a home run with Azani, and I cannot wait to see him in training camp and hear your reports.
Yeah, it can always be. It is really tough to judge positional coaches. That, you know, the deeper you go and the more removed from the field you get, the harder it is to judge somebody. But just from those clips and my own, you know, watching Chrisman Jackson training camp, who I think seems to be a quality person, I think he's probably a fine receivers coach. But Azani seems to be, as you said, more vocal, more energy. And that isn't always, you know, doesn't always translate into becoming a great coach, but I think it is different and something this unit needs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously Chrisman Jackson, I think he would have been better with a veteran receiver room, not a a position group with a Pickens, a Chase Claypool, a Deontay Johnson. And I think the Steelers finally realized that. Obviously, Chase Claypool's not here any longer, but they have young guys at the position that need to learn how to be pros, how to conduct themselves professionally. So you have to have that veteran coach. And I honestly, I think that they did a really good job targeting Azani and landing him and taking advantage of a rather strange decision by the Jets to move on from him after a year in which, you know, Garrett Wilson, I believe he garnered some all-pro consideration, and then all of a sudden they changed receiver coaches. So, you know, the Steelers were fortunate to have a guy like Azani come available, and I think they did a really good job getting the type of coach they need for this current position group.
You're right. It is a bit strange. Azani got dumped after 1 year. I know the Jets receivers didn't have outstanding production, but given the horrible quarterback situation they were in, I think it's, from my point of view, 30,000 foot view, it's hard to blame the receivers coach for that. They just, you lose Aaron Rodgers 4 plays into the year and your whole plan and identity goes out the window. So did you do any research on why he was let go? If there was any sort of pushback or surprise to that? Was this kind of Robert Saleh? When you're kind of in that, are you going to stay? Are you going to get fired? Kind of just scapegoating and making changes to try to appease ownership. Do you have any idea why he was fired and if there was a surprise with that?
Yeah, what I looked into was, you know, Saleh was a bit disappointed in the receiver group outside of Garrett Wilson. You know, obviously they spent a lot of money on Alan Lazard and he was quite frankly not good. But again, outside of Garrett Wilson, what receiver was good in New York last year with the quarterbacks that they dealt with? It did feel a little bit like a scapegoat move, though. You know, Garrett Wilson was pretty upset. I believe he took to Twitter and just thanked Azani for the work that he did and how he helped make him a better receiver. But it's not like they went in a strange direction. They hired a former NFL receiver in Sean Jefferson, who has a long track record. But it did feel like Saleh kind of put a lot of the offensive struggles on the receivers because of the money that they spent at the position. And unfortunately, Azani was made out to be the scapegoat. And, the Steelers are fortunate that was the case, and I don't think him being let go by the Jets should be any indictment on him.
Last question. This may be completely random. It probably is, but I cannot find the answer to this. With Azani, do you know what RAD means, R-A-D? He's used this acronym his entire coaching career, and I cannot figure out what RAD or R-A-D means. Do you happen to know by any chance?
I cannot find it. He had it on a cutoff sweater in training camp with the Jets and the Broncos. I cannot find it. I've asked Broncos reporters that friends with, and they are like, yeah, I got no clue. So I can't find it. Maybe that's something we hopefully someone in the Pittsburgh media listens to this and can ask him when he has availability, because I want to know. He has it everywhere. You know, it was from the college level, it's the NFL level. He had it on his play sheet at one point in training camp.
Oh, really?
You could see it at the top in that mic'd up segment with the Broncos. I don't know, but whatever it is, he believes in it strongly. So I'd love to find out what it is.
Yeah, me too. So if anybody happens to know, Zach Azani, if you're listening to this, as I'm sure that you are, let us know, because probably just some, I don't know, standard acronym for some philosophy there. It's probably nothing earth-shattering, but I would like to know, because, I mean, I've literally seen it over his entire bio, and I think he signed an autograph, a picture of AB of one time, and it had RAD on there. I just want to know what it means, just for my own curiosity. All right, we'll switch gears now to, you have any thoughts on Tom Arth? I don't know if you did any research on him. I know you didn't write the article, but did you have any particular thoughts on that?
The only thought I really had was I thought it was a bit unfair of people to kind of blame him for maybe some of the quote-unquote regression that Justin Herbert had in 2023. I don't think that that was Tom Arth's doing. I mean, the first year Tom Arth worked with Justin Herbert finished top 10 in MVP votes and cut down on turnovers, sacks. He had an increase in completion percentage. Just a smart guy. I think you wrote, isn't he one of the greatest players in John Carroll University history? He just seems like a really smart guy. Has some solid experience. And I thought he got some of the best play out of Herbert as that quarterback coach / passing game coordinator. But yeah, last year with the Chargers, everything was a mess. So kind of taking anything there from Arth is pointless for me.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm excited that they have a younger quarterback coach that has experience working with a high-end quarterback. Again, that's not a knock on Mike Sullivan, but yeah, I was expecting Arth to be the passing game coordinator, and now he's the quarterback coach. So I'm excited to see what he can bring to the table.
And now we'll see what role and title Mike Sullivan has, still listed as quarterback coach alongside Arth on the team site. So I guess they're still figuring those things out. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be, will Sullivan have a pass game title, which does not typically happen in Pittsburgh. Will he be assistant head coach? Will it be, could be assistant quarterbacks coach, I suppose, because David Corley's gone. I don't know. So we'll stay tuned.
What do you think he'll get? What I would imagine it would be assistant head coach. That would be the only logical thing. But what are you, kind of how are you feeling about the whole Sullivan situation?
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense. It's been available since John Mitchell retired. And Mitchell was working in also part of a liaison type role, which I don't know if Sullivan would have, because Mitchell was doing stuff as kind of alumni and transitioning players from the post-playing days. It could be something like that. I'd be more curious on the actual role, because title can be whatever, but what are you actually doing? What is your role? Right. How are you working with the offense? What part of the game are you game planning? What's your role on game day? You know, will he have some sort of, you know, upstairs booth role as an overseer? Could there be a potential to help clock management or something? I mean, he's never been a head coach, but he's been an OC. He's a veteran of the game. Could he kind of be a set of eyes and ears for Tomlin in that regard? I really don't know. I'm kind of surprised he's still here. You hire Tom Arth and, you know, you freeze Sullivan out of the OC interview process. Don't even consider him from the get-go. If I was Mike Sullivan, I'd be looking for another job personally, but like maybe he's under contract and didn't have any other place to go.
And not only that, I mean, that's a guy that obviously you want to bring back Mason Rudolph. You have Kenny Pickett still on the roster. Those two guys have spoken glowingly about Sullivan. Is there some sort of conflict with a guy like Sullivan in the room with Arth? You know, wouldn't you just want to avoid that? So I'm very curious to see what his role will be, especially if it's not going to be as quarterback coach, what they're going to do with him.
One article you wrote recently, Josh, I think you got some pushback for it about the punter situation.
Oh, yes.
With Presley Harvin being released on Monday. No punter currently on the roster. You know, what path do you take to acquire that next punter? I think you talked about go draft somebody and got some pushback for that. So kind of make your case of why you're still in favor of drafting a punter, even though the Harvin pick did not work out.
Yeah, certainly got some pushback. I had, you know, the guy I have circled is Torrey Taylor from Iowa. I think obviously that guy has a great track record at the collegiate level. Some people are concerned with the age. He'll be 26, but you can punt into your 40s. It's right. Not like it, you know.
He's 26? I didn't
he's
know
20,
that.
Yeah, he's 26. So he's on the older side. But I mean, some of his punts at Iowa are incredible. He has an incredible tape with the Hawkeyes. I think he punted almost 100 times last season, which is an indictment on their offense overall. But yeah, it just, you know, they went the Harvin route, and people want to say, oh, he was the best punter in college that year. He was the only punter drafted. That's more of an indictment on that actual punting class than it would be saying much about Harvin. I think you wrote in your report there were concerns about, you know, consistency issues in college, and I think we saw that at the NFL level in 3 years. I just want this team to understand that the punting position is so important, especially with the style of play that they want to lean into, which is running the football, you know, controlling the game in that standpoint, leaning on their defense overall. And to help that defense, you want to be able to pin opposing offenses deep. I know that they obviously deploy a directional punting style, but I want to see them invest highly in a punter. You know, people were saying, they did that with Harvin. Well, that was a 7th-round pick. Then people brought up Daniel Sepulveda, which that was a flashback name. You know, I just think you look at the last few years, and I had this in my article, some of the top punters in the league have been drafted in that fourth, fifth, sixth round range. There were even some guys drafted in the third round. You know, and I know that this team has some holes, and the thought of spending a fourth round pick on a punter seems absolutely wild. You know, it still does to me, but I think Taylor's that kind of that game changing weapon in the punting game. And if you can get him or a guy like Ryan Reckow from BYU, I know Joe Clark talked to him at the Shrine Bowl, and just the way that guy was booming punts throughout the week was really impressive. So I don't want to see this team, you know, no pun intended, punt on the punting position again, and just kind of find that bargain bin guy. If you're not going to go, you know, heavy in the draft at the position, I'd like to see them spend some money in free agency for one of these proven top guys. But I think that the better option is to do it in the draft with one of those two fourth round picks. And, you know, I think come the season, if they're leaning on a guy like Torrey Taylor, that people aren't going to care where he was drafted if he's doing his job at a high level like he did in college. So that's where I'm at. I mean, you look at how the league is shifting. I mean, look at the Ravens. They spent a fourth round pick on Jordan Stout, and he's given them two great years, and he's been a weapon for them. Jake Camardo was picked right after him in 2022, and he's been great for Tampa. So you're seeing smart teams invest in the punting position, and that's what I want to see the Steelers do, because it's been an issue for them for quite a while.
And even in the Super Bowl, the punters were the all-stars at one point. Tommy Townsend for the Chiefs and Mitch Wisnowski for the 49ers. So it is critical for the way Pittsburgh's built, where you want to flip the field and your offense. Hopefully it'll be better. It needs to be better, but it's still not going to be potent or, you know, put up 30 points per game. So you need that weapon. It's a starter. What was the stat that you had? 7 of the 10 top punters in average were draft picks or something like that?
Yeah, 7 of the 10 out of net punting yards per punt this past season were draft picks. So I got a lot of people that say, you know, oh, you can go on the waiver wire, or you can sign an undrafted free agent, or what may be. And it's like, well, the league is investing more and more in the kicking game, whether it's punting or kicking. And I think that obviously the Steelers tried that with Harvin. It didn't work out, but that shouldn't cause them to think twice about doing it again. You know, each situation is different. And I think this is a very, very good punting class, especially with Taylor at the top. And you're going to have to spend a premium pick to get that guy. And I would be good with it with one of those two fourth round picks. I think that makes the most sense for me. And, you know, like I said, I got a lot of pushback on Twitter from it and in the article. And I still stand by it. And I think it will not matter where they get that punter if they spend that fourth round pick and he plays very well in 2024 and beyond.
Sure, I'm not opposed to it, but you better get it right. I mean, that's one you just can't, you know, if you've missed on a fourth round different position, that's one thing, but a punter with how kind of visible it is, you got to get that one, you know, 100%
you cannot,
right.
Yeah, you cannot be the New England Patriots of 2021 and whiff on Jake Bailey in the fourth round and then have to draft a punter 2 years later. So you got to get it right.
But I think even Reckow that you mentioned from BYU, I know Taylor is kind of the talk as a top punter, but his career he's one of the best punters in college football history. I think right behind Ryan Stonehouse, he's one of the best punters in the NFL today with Tennessee. So that's a name that I want to learn more about and do a profile on at some point.
Yeah, he's quite the story. I really think it's a very good punting class, and I want to see the Steelers get involved in it. This isn't the same class, you know, type of class that Harvin was in, where, again, he was the only punter drafted. We could see 3-4 punters get drafted in this class.
Yeah, at least two, I think, and potentially at least more than that. Last thing to talk about, Josh, Kevin Colbert was on a North Catholic high school athletics podcast, which is where he's from, a North Catholic kid. And so it was a cool opportunity for the people, I think students, they were to talk with Kevin Colbert, and they probably didn't expect it to become one of the biggest stories in Pittsburgh, I think, Wednesday. And one of the most, I think, controversial comments that Colbert made that certainly the internet found and ran with after he wrote about it was Colbert's take on analytics. And he was asked, you know, are analytics overused? And Colbert said, you know, essentially, yes, they are overused by the NFL. And he's somebody that focuses on hearts and smarts and tangibles, all things he espoused and talked about repeatedly in Pittsburgh. And so the analytics crowd found that on Twitter and ran with that and had a lot of pushback there. What were your thoughts on Colbert's comments?
I mean, I wasn't surprised by them. I think his track record late in his career showed his thoughts on analytics. I mean, the Steelers had one of the smallest analytics staffs in the league. So I wasn't surprised by it. You know, I know that when we put that article out there, it blew up, and rightfully so. But that's a guy that's been around football since the late 90s. Of course, he's going to have that thought process of, you know, analytics can't measure intangibles. Like that wasn't surprising to me, but it was him saying the quiet part out loud where it was like, oh, Kevin, like you don't have to, you know, do this. But no, I wasn't surprised, Alex. I mean, like I said, some of his moves late in his career showed that. And I mean, even in game, let's be honest, Mike Tomlin isn't really an analytics guy. He's more of a gut feel guy. So
yeah,
wasn't all that surprising. And it also wasn't surprising to see the internet take it and run with it.
Yeah, in fairness to Colbert, he didn't completely dismiss analytics. Right. Here's part of the quote after he said that he believes they are overused. He said, quote, "At the end of my career with the Steelers, obviously it came into play, and I used to encourage our younger scouts and say, keep me up to date, tell me what I'm missing. We had analytics people, and I used to challenge them. I said, when you guys can measure the intangibles, let me know, because that's the most important thing," end quote. And so he saw the usefulness of them. And I could tell, I mean, the team certainly, I'm sure, had the information. It's really about how much you value the information and how you infuse the information into the process. And analytics should not be a substitute for tape and watching, you know, film on guys and watching guys in person, getting to know them, the background. That is all, I think, very, very important, and which was near and dear to Colbert. There's just a line and a balance that you have to work overall. And I think Colbert still didn't necessarily value them enough.
Yeah. And my pushback on that would have been, if I were the interviewer, of, okay, Kevin, what are analytics to you? You know,
yeah.
Define the analytics that you're concerned with, because, you know, I saw some people say, well, of course he's not into analytics. That's why he traded up for an inside linebacker or drafted a running back in the first round. It's like, are those analytics? Like, is that positional analytics? Like, what analytics are we talking about here? Is it the decision to go for it in certain situations, or positional value in general, or, you know, height, weight, speed, stuff like that? I would have liked to know what he defines as analytics, because he talked about you can't measure those intangible things, the hearts and smarts. So I would have liked a little bit more explanation from him there as to what he truly views analytics as. But, you know, that's all we got from him. And like I said, I wasn't surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think the comment of him challenging analytics people and saying, when you guys can measure the intangibles, let me know. I mean, of course they can't measure that concretely. That's, I think, just a fruitless thing to tell somebody. I think he kind of misses the point of what analytics can be and can't be and the usefulness. But again, I know that they use them. I mean, heck, when they missed on Jarvis Jones, all they did in the first round after that was draft a bunch of athletes. Like, all their guys had really high relative athletic scores. And I don't know for sure if that's what they were using, but there was a common theme between they wanted athletes. I'm pretty sure after they missed on Jarvis Jones, they kind of took a look and said, you know, because Colbert had the quip when Jones ran like a 4.9 at the combine. He's like, I'm happy he ran 4.9 because he fell in the draft to us and regretted, I'm sure, him running that. So he probably wishes he would have ran a 4.5, wouldn't have gotten to Pittsburgh and wouldn't have missed on him. So they made the adjustment from there, and maybe some ways even overcorrected and focused too much on the athleticism. But you can certainly kind of feel they had types of guys, and they certainly had their benchmarks as well. So I do want to give them some credit, because I don't think they were completely anti-analytics, but they, I'm sure, valued them less than most teams. And that was evident because they kept losing all their analytics people. They would just go somewhere else. Kareem Kaysen left for Duolingo, the Spanish, you know, or the language learning software, and Jay Whitmire left for the Jets, and Will Britt recently left for Dallas. And so when you have guys that just jump ship for other teams, other opportunities, that kind of tells you how their work is being valued or not being valued.
Yeah. And the one thing I would push back on with some of the criticism of Colbert too is like, okay, you want the Steelers to be more into analytics than they have been. But at the same time, some of these people that were pushing back on Colbert's comments were also crushing a guy like Dan Campbell, who was aggressive and leaned heavily into analytics with his decision-making. It's like, what do you want? Where is that middle ground that would appease people? Because I honestly, I think if Mike Tomlin were to adapt that Dan Campbell style, I think people would lose their minds. So it's like, what where is the middle ground with analytics in football today? That's something I struggle with. You know, a little off topic here. You look at baseball, that's all you talk about is the analytics at this point. It has taken over the game, and I think it's getting that way with football. But where is that middle ground of, okay, these numbers matter, these numbers aren't as important, this is what you need in a player evaluation, this is what you can kind of use as an argument. I just want to know where that middle ground is, and I don't think we're at that point yet.
I'm not sure if we ever will, because I don't know if you can, you know, neatly draw that line. It's going to vary team to team. I mean, analytics will grow and become more important and more prevalent in all aspects of football evaluation, draft, in-game, otherwise. I mean, heck, at practice, you have guys on these, you know, tracking devices of how many steps they have, what their mileage is, and all those kinds of things. And that's all well and good. And I think Pittsburgh's used that, I'm sure, like the rest of the NFL, and gotten a bunch of useful information of that. My concern is just Pittsburgh to have too small of an analytics group and not even having enough information or not enough valuing that information to compete in a world that's, you know, trending that way.
Yeah. And do you feel that they're trending in the right direction when it comes to that, or is it still going to be that long, slow slog in a sense for the Steelers organization?
It's hard to tell. I mean, you can assume once Omar Khan, Andy White will, you know, come in and or be elevated in Khan's case, they're going to value that more as kind of younger, more new age type of people. I haven't seen, from a staffing standpoint, much of a change. They still have two people with an analytic title right now in Tosin Kazim, who does some scouting as well. And then they hired Donovan Brooks last September to replace Will Britt, who left for Dallas. Mm-hmm. But to me, even again, it's not always about, because you could hire 10 people to work analytics and present information. If you don't utilize that information, it doesn't really matter how many people you have working on that. And to the question of, you know, how much do they use it? I really couldn't tell you for sure, especially.
Well, I know that Patrick Peterson said during the season that Mike Tomlin doesn't rely on analytics, you know, leaning up into game planning or advanced scouting. Right. So it's how much information are they getting and how much are they using it is the question.
Yeah. There's a difference between having it and using it and utilizing it and utilizing it the right way, and that balance, which we can, you know, talk about for hours and probably never come to a real, you know, concrete conclusion on. But that was the comment. I think, you know, I'm not going to be somebody that bashes Kevin Colbert. I think people like to take some glee in trashing him and kind of forget how quality of a GM that he was, but it is fair to say, I think Pittsburgh was putting themselves at some sort of disadvantage by the end. And I think even at the end, Colbert did some good things. I think my biggest critique of him was 2022. A, I don't think he should have been the GM for that final year. I think he should have stepped down after I guess it would have been the 2021 season after Ben retired, instead of going through the entire offseason process. Then they hire a GM, Colbert officially steps down, and he kind of just, you know, you lost it off season for the new guy, for Khan and for Andy White. And plus, I think the decisions in 2022 were not great in terms of the Okorafor deal, the Ogunjobi contracts not looking too strong. Of course, Kenny Pickett, if that doesn't work out, then that'll be a mark on Colbert's resume negatively. So that's really my biggest critique. And no one ever talks about that, but he should have not gone through 2022, that offseason. He should have been stepping down then. They go through the GM search like any other team that might have fired their GM, hired somebody then, and let him go through that process. You look at a Baltimore, when Ozzie Newsome stepped down, that was right after a season ended, and then Eric DaCosta took over for that offseason. That happened in Green Bay when Ted Thompson stepped down. I think it was Brian Gutekunst that came in. That was right after the season. You rarely see GMs that will go through the bulk of the offseason post-draft, and then they make a change. Only time that's ever happened, it's like somebody got fired. I think the Jets with Mike Maccagnan a couple years back.
They hired Joe Douglas. Yep.
Which was a disaster in a million ways.
Right. And this isn't you having recency bias or anything like that, like, or, you know, the opportunity of hindsight. You were saying this at the time too. Like this was a very puzzling decision from the franchise for your perspective when it happened immediately. It was like, why is Kevin Colbert in charge of the offseason? Why is he in charge of the draft? Like, just make the move now. And yeah, I mean, that offseason was pretty tough for the Steelers. It's not looking great, especially, you know, the draft with Pickett and that decision. You know, obviously Mike Tomlin had a hand in that as well. And from all, you know, aspects, it seems like Omar Khan was 100% on board with Pickett, but It would have just been better if they could have made that move to the next GM as soon as the season ended and let them have that full offseason. Because right now it feels like Khan and Weidel are kind of playing catch up to try and make up for some of these mistakes. And that's, I think that's what Ray Fittipaldo said earlier in the week that I wrote the article about. The Steelers are in a bad cycle right now with draft misses and having to spend some money in free agency and kind of getting away from that build through the draft, develop our own guys situation. And it's been a tough task for Khan and Weidel, but they had a good offseason this past year.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some debate about, I think, what Fittipaldo said, probably for a different time. But and again, it's not even, you know, it could have been a good offseason for Cole, but I still would have had the same gripe, I guess, in principle, just because I think it's just bad process. But I think you've had the results, obviously, on top of that. The results don't look too good. And that's a criticism of Colbert that I would levy heavier and more so than the analytics part of it. But no one really ever talks about that aspect anymore.
100%. Yeah, 100% agree with you.
All right, Josh, any final thoughts? You want anything else you wanted to talk about that we did not get to?
No, that's really it. I know that, Monday they kind of made all the moves all at once, which was rather surprising. I think things are going to be a little quiet here for the next few weeks. And we'll see what happens with, you know, obviously Mason Rudolph ahead of free agency and all that. And I think as I sit here now, Alex, I think Rudolph signs elsewhere and we're going to have Ryan Tannehill and Kenny Pickett and some draft pick. that's just gut feel right now.
Yeah, for as much talk as there is about Justin Fields and some more Kirk Cousins media chatter, I think it's far more likely either Rudolph resigns or they sign a veteran equivalent like a Tannehill or somebody else like that. Those are probably the two most likely names right now in Rudolph and Tannehill. I think they're it's far more plausible that's the direction Pittsburgh goes than trading for Justin Fields.
Yeah, it's fun to talk about Justin Fields. Obviously, there's that clip from the Ohio State Pro Day in 21. With Tomlin saying, you know why we're here, you know, put on a show, but there's too many variables that you know, have to be tackled with the whole field situation. And I don't think the Steelers would justify picking up a almost $22 million 50-year option without seeing him play a snap for them. So, it's just media chatter.
It's just what Dave Bryan has talked about if you trade for him, you almost have to pick up the option. You're tied to him for the next 2 years. Pittsburgh's not looking for that. They want competition. They're not closing the book on Kenny Pickett. You trade for Justin Fields. That book is closed on Pickett. That is not the path Pittsburgh's headed in right now. Right or wrong, that's not where they want to go.
Yeah, and I think Dave Wanstead said something recently very similar on NBC Sports Chicago. Like, the Steelers still believe in Pickett. So, you know, they say things to the media that might not always be true, but it is not the Steelers' mode of operation to give up on a first-round draft pick after 2 years. You have to believe Tomlin and Rooney, you know, at their word, what they said this offseason, and they still believe in Pickett, and they're not going to go out and sign a Kirk Cousins or a Russell Wilson or trade for a Justin Fields, because that closes the book on Kenny Pickett, right or wrong. And that would be that. And that's just not the way the Steelers do business. So your best bet is Rudolph, Tannehill, maybe a Jacoby Brissett, and a draft pick.
I mean, I would say it's your best bet. You can debate if it's the right strategy, but I just think that's what's going to happen. That's the path of Pittsburgh, the reality of the situation. And we can talk about Fields. You can say it's the right move. I mean, I'm not going to be enthralled by a Kenny Pickett, Tannehill quarterback battle. No. I don't know if that's going to go get where Pittsburgh wants to go, but I just think the media is talking about it a lot more than Pittsburgh's actually entertaining the idea.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, you brought up a great point, something that I didn't have in the initial article but made sure to add. Mark Sadowski was the director of college scouting for the Bears when Fields was picked. So, you know, there was that report from Brad Spielberger from PFF that members of the front office are big Justin Fields fans. Well, there's probably one of them, but
yeah.
Again, that doesn't mean that they're going to go out and get him. You know, if that 50-year option wasn't hanging out there, if you know, this was maybe last year or whatever it may be, maybe it's more plausible. But yeah, Dave's covered it a ton. I can't see it. And it just feels like we are going to get beat over the head for the next 4 weeks with Justin Fields and Steelers talk.
Yeah, we already have it. I'm kind of already tired of the story, but I know we'll have to keep discussing it. I mean, Sadowski may love Fields, and he probably did like him coming out, considering the role that he was in when Chicago drafted him. And Sadowski is close with Omar Khan. They go way back to Tulane, and he was one of the first hires that Khan made whenever he became GM in That would have been, what was that, May of 2022. But Sadowski's not the decision maker. It's Omar Khan. It's Mike Tomlin. It's Art Rooney. And so what they say, what they think is what matters.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, it's a story that's not going away anytime soon. I don't think the Kirk Cousins story is going away anytime soon either, especially after the report that came out the other day that, what was it, Florio said that the Cousins camp is monitoring Pittsburgh and Atlanta. That's not going anywhere. But, yeah, I think your best bet of what happens is Rudolph, Tannehill, insert veteran free agent here on an affordable deal and probably a day three draft pick.
I'm with you, Josh. So any other final thoughts or anything else to wrap up with?
No, that's it. And I appreciate you having me on. And like I said at the top, I hope Dave's enjoying his vacation. And yeah, we're rolling along here in the off season.
Yeah, for sure. So we'll be back, I think, for Monday. I'll definitely have a Monday live stream, YouTube live stream. It'll just be, I think, me an hour over there, and then it'll get posted to the site. I'm not entirely sure what we'll do for the podcast. I may have Josh back on, may have somebody else, may have a couple of people on. I do want to get our Tom Mead on at some point this draft season to get some of his thoughts as well. But Josh, thank you again for filling in for Friday, at least.
Absolutely, man. I really appreciate you having me on.
All right, time for my world-famous outros. I keep forgetting to do until I jump on the mic here and I go, I got to do the outro today. So I may mess this up entirely, but we're going to roll with it. And please judge kindly here for however I end this thing. So you can follow Josh Carney on Twitter at, as I got to pull up his name because I forgot to have it pulled up here, at by Josh Carney. You can follow myself on Twitter at Alex_Kazura. Sure to follow Dave on Twitter at Steels Depot. You want to comment into the site, you can send us an email at theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.